We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, author of The Known Citizen, A History of Privacy in Modern America. Sarah Igo, thanks so much for coming on to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with the title. It is a reference to a poem by W.H. Auden from 1940, The Unknown Citizen. What was it about that that poem that spurred the title?
I'm so glad you asked that. It's a lovely poem. It is, as you say, from 1940, and a poem that charts the life of a man who is anonymous. He's never named in the poem, but is known by all kinds of different agencies in the society. You know, his creditors, his doctors, labor union, journalists, pollsters, and so forth. And when I stumbled upon it, it just spoke to me in a way that it captured a dilemma for Americans around privacy, which is both their desire to be known and their desire to be unknown at the same time, or maybe better, their desire to be known as they wish, but usually aren't. So it really, I don't know, in a kind of very succinct way seemed to capture up many of the themes that I was thinking about in terms of the history of American debates over privacy, and to eloquently, lay them in front of us.
Let's talk. I feel like it's too broad of a question to ask, like, what is privacy? But I think that's sort of in many respects, that's the point of the book, is that it shifts, the concept of it shifts over time. And you start to track it basically at the beginning of the 20th century, just a little bit maybe before that. So let's do that. I mean, in terms of, and hit some of the milestones, but when did the concept of privacy really become most, establish itself on the scene, as it were, within the context of society?
Sure. So, I mean, privacy, I think, is a very old human concept, even if it's been, taken different forms. So I would not say it began in any simple way in the late 19th century, which is where I begin the book. But what I do want to argue is that privacy became a kind of public issue, a political issue, for the first time for many people in American society. And that it never really left the stage thereafter, obviously not today, but really for all the years in between. So what happens in the late 19th century is that a series of developments, the kind of creation of the national mass media, some technological innovations, photography, instantaneous photography, fingerprinting, a whole bunch of other things, start to create a crisis in the boundaries around private persons, and to raise questions about what could and should be known about Americans. How should they be known to the broader society? So it's sparked in the first instance really by new technologies and new media. So in some ways, it has some interesting correspondences, I think, to our own moment. But, more than a century ago, we're talking about the 1880s and 1890s, when candid photographs could be circulated easily for the first time, could be printed in the newspaper, where people could be caught unawares and recorded by new kinds of devices. This will provoke for a couple of lawyers the first modern call for the right to privacy, which is in 1890 in the Harvard Law Journal.
And this
so
is,
that's a beginning point. Yeah.
And I want to get to that concept that Brandeis, forwarded, but so at that time, right? I mean, it seems to me that when we're talking right around then too, it's like there's a question of like privacy as anonymity, privacy as sort of control over your domain, and I imagine too, we're talking about an era where for most people, they didn't have a huge amount of property, right? Personal property or whatnot. And there wasn't necessarily, I guess there's also a question of like, who can enter my domicile in some way? And all these things get implicated with the technology. And then, as you say, this concept of the right to be left alone is privacy. Let's talk mm-hmm. about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So so the older ideas about privacy in the United States, certainly legal ideas, had to do with this property idea, right? One's home, a man's home is his castle, which comes out of Anglo old Anglo American law. And what really changes in the late 19th century is that those borders no longer seem to protect the people that they used to protect, which was generally, you know, white propertied men, to really sort of sum up, you know, who privacy had protected in the past. And but suddenly new kinds of communications technologies, virtual technologies like photography could kind of cross those borders and boundaries. So in the first instance, this privacy crisis really is a crisis around middle, you know, upper middle class property rights, and the privileged people in American society suddenly realizing they can be witnessed and observed and captured on film and sort of trotted out in the scandal press in a new way. But it doesn't stay there for long. And in fact, this idea that people might have a right to protections from not just physical intrusions, but virtual intrusions, travels really far really quickly. So you get suits in the late 19th century, some of the earliest right to privacy suits that are actually coming from women whose photographs, whose images are being used in advertising and all kinds of ways that they didn't authorize, didn't even know about oftentimes. And start claiming a right to privacy that is not about, you know, break-ins into one's home or property, but really about incursions on one's reputation, one's image, one's public persona, one's dignity. And so the notion of privacy really changes from one that's based in property, never fully escapes that, but that's really grounded in property, to one that's more grounded in personality, which is the term that Louis Brandeis and Samuel Warren will use in that 1890 Harvard Law Review essay.
Now, is there a distinction at that time between the idea of, like, okay, you took my picture, use it for an advertisement, the concept of privacy versus sort of you've taken my, it's you know, you've taken my property, you've taken my, you know, my, what we would now, I guess, call on some level intellectual property, right? Because it's interesting that this, that we start to see these suits in the context of, and maybe that's why we only see them in the context of civil suits, but in terms of, like, issues of exploitation of people's, of things that people don't want to put into the marketplace, but it's an exploitation as opposed to just simply like a leering.
Right. Well, so that's a really interesting question. It's first of all, this market is totally unregulated in the late 19th century. There are no rules about circulation of photographs yet. And so actually what there are a number of different reasons one might wish to protest one's image being circulated, but the most common ones are not about having some sort of financial interest or property interest in that sense, but more so about the kind of embarrassment or shame of having one's face kind of paraded around in commercial culture, which particularly for women could seem quite scandalous. I mean, it was to have yourself mixed up in the market and in commercial transactions was akin, you know, in some readings to prostitution or, you know, to a kind of unsavory public presence. So there were a number of different ways that this could play out, but I think that it's really a later development of people wanting to profit from, say, their image or to capitalize on their image, and so they're getting more into kind of intellectual property sorts of rights or the, you know, sort of celebrity rights over their image, you know, a right to publicity actually, which is related in odd ways to a right to privacy.
And
the
then,
right to profit from publicity, that is.
Okay, and so then we, as we move into, you know, the pre, I guess, New Deal era, where the, sort of the concept of privacy changes, where are we there? Like, what, I mean, it's interesting because we don't have this fear, really, of the government when it comes to privacy, right? It's just other actors around us.
Yeah, well, in the 19th century, that's pretty much true. I mean, certainly there are cases where, and they're sort of memorialized, right, in American law in a way about quartering soldiers or, right, the government breaking down the door. But that was not a very live or regular concern for most Americans in the 19th century, actually. And where the threat comes from is actually commercial entities, other private entities in the first instance. But in the 20th century, as you point out, there starts to be a growing fear about the administrative state, about what the state knows about people, how it is tracking people as a kind of more fully blown social welfare state comes into play. And as more people are paying taxes in the 20th century, people are starting to benefit from federal social programs like Social Security. There's a new regime of documentation around birth certificates. To travel out of the country, one needs a passport. So all of these documents, which seem, age old, but are actually pretty new inventions, come onto the scene and create a new set of worries about documentation, identification by various kinds of state bureaucracies. And I should say not only state bureaucracies even there, because we're also talking about credit agencies and what they know about Americans. Some worry starts to creep in there, too, in the early 20th century. So fears or discussions, debates around privacy change, not to be about just sort of publicity and exposure, but start to encompass worries about information and about what we would now call data privacy or information privacy. People didn't call it that then, but they were clearly starting to worry about all the different kind of pieces of information that various kinds of authorities, private or public, knew about them.
And so this is as we develop into what you call a knowing society, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so, I mean, I'm really fascinated because I wasn't aware, because I was aware that the Social Security number was supposed to be highly limited and in terms of its use. And then, of course, it ultimately became far more abused, and we have a lot more, problems associated with, identity theft and whatnot at this point. But I didn't realize how excited people were about the Social Security number because of the implications it had in terms of government. And I wonder how much of the development of, we'll get to how people's perspective on privacy shifted, I think, in the Cold War, because there was, an agenda being set there. But I wonder how much of that sort of table setting was there with the idea of people, because it seems like most of the concern about the Social Security number at that time were of opponents of the idea of Social Security in and of itself. But speak about the different currents of excitement, because I just didn't realize how that people, I mean, I think at one point you're saying, people were tattooing their Social Security numbers on them. This,
right,
of course, is before
right,
the
yeah.
Holocaust and, where such, tattoos became, meant something totally different. But people wearing dog tags with it. Talk about that era and the differing views on the Social Security number.
Sure. Yeah. This was one of the biggest surprises to me when doing research for this book. I had actually turned to Social Security numbers because I expected that there we would see this early privacy debate about information, right? The state all of a sudden, first of all, putting a number on people, and then second, being able to use that number to, as a kind of index to their work history, financial lives, and so forth. And there was a little bit of that, although much of the early pushback against Social Security numbers was, as you say, about opponents of the program or about big government or about tracking of union members in particular. And there were some other scattered concerns. But what really bowled me over was the embrace of these numbers, as identifying numbers that would show citizens, would prove, citizen status to the government as deserving of support, whether for unemployment benefits or for welfare, retirement benefits. So there's this really rich kind of material history that I started digging into of people getting jewelry with their Social Security numbers, emblazoned on it, special bronze plates that they would display in their homes, getting their dentures, marked with their social security number, and then this trend that was, never huge, but was not all that small either, of people getting their social security numbers tattooed on their bodies, permanently making that number part of their identity, as a kind of badge of pride and belonging, economic citizenship. You could look at those in a number of different ways, but certainly not hiding them, and certainly not treating that number as a kind of private fact about themselves. On the contrary, sometimes really broadcasting that number. And that really carries all the way through the 30s and 40s and into the 50s, and it really only starts to change dramatically in the 1950s, sorry, in the 1960s, when social security numbers start entering into new computer data banks and start getting linked in new ways to other pieces of information.
Before we get to there, too, though, I'm also fascinated by the idea that the social security number was received in part because the concerns that many people had was less about the government and more about their bosses. That
yes.
It seems like
yes.
The social security number was like, okay, here's my token. You no longer have to know what religion I am or what my marital status is or what all these other things. Here's the token that just, if this number's okay, then I'm okay. Is that basically the dynamic?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah,
to me.
That's right. And also the fact that, workers had been surveilled by their employers for a long time. And there was a lot of distrust and skepticism about employers' intent. And actually, here was the federal government coming in as an intermediary and securing certain kinds of things for workers. And what workers were really worried about was not the government having their information, but making sure the employers would not have access to the government's stashes of information. So, yeah, that was a really interesting discovery that really, just tells you that relationships between Americans and the state were different, right? And private agencies were different than they are today. And we shouldn't assume that their privacy fears were the same as ours, right? Those relationships have really changed over the course of the last century.
I mean, I find that so fascinating. And I'm not, I come with my own predispositions, but I can't help but think that a combination of the Cold War, where we were sold this notion of how dangerous, a government could be, right, in terms and that there was an agenda or a value to the employer class to sever that relationship that people were feeling between them and their government, and that they wanted to make them more skeptical of their government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it, this is the Social Security number is a nice case, both because Americans seem more trusting than we might expect as a federal government, but also because even though corporate America was very invested in not letting Social Security pass, which of course it did, leapt on the possibilities of the Social Security number for surveilling their employees. So I talk about this in some detail in the book, but employers started creating their own fictitious surveys of employees, claiming that they were related to them getting a Social Security number, which they asked for much more extensive information about their personal lives than the federal government ever did. So yeah, that relationship, I think, is worthy of a second look, right, about the kind of shifting ways in which corporations have both led distrust in the United States and also have fostered distrust in other big agencies, namely the federal government.
That's fascinating. And to what extent, too, and I guess maybe this runs parallel to this, but the idea of who was deserving privacy expands in some way. And I wonder if where the Social Security number comes in that respect, too, because that is, on some level, it's the great equalizer, right? I mean, like, everybody gets a number. And, to say you're all just a number in some ways may be dehumanizing, but it's also quite egalitarian.
Yeah, it is. Although, of course, not everybody did get a number, and there were racial disparities. Yeah,
of course. And we have spoken about this on this program, and there should be an asterisk on everything that we're talking about in this context.
We're talking about
a narrow set of Americans, or I should say maybe a wide set, but there were certainly huge swaths of Americans who were left out. People of color and women were, in some respects, targeted to not receive Social Security benefits at that time.
That's right. But, the larger point, I think, is really important. And often, especially these days when we're so concerned about documentation and identity theft and data breaches, the larger point is that, identification by the federal government, being visible to the federal government in this case because of a benefits program, was very, very, very valuable. It was a kind of prized possession. And this is why Social Security numbers played a different role in Americans' lives then, right? So to hold on to this number, to be able to recall it, to be able to, produce it, was seen as something really precious. So, of course, its history would zigzag on from there and start, we now think of them quite differently. But documentation and identification could be really, really sought after kinds of statuses for Americans, right? So anyway, I feel like that's a really important point to make because it helps us see that there's not an inevitable relationship between kind of negative surveillance and documentation, right? There can be other arrangements, yeah.
And then that everything turns a little bit south, in part because there's a desire to make the Soviet Union more nefarious, but also it seems in part because our government started to snoop on its own citizens in a particularly aggressive fashion, right? When we get into the late 60s and early 70s. And how does that impact privacy there? Because I imagine there's also this dynamic of, that there's a portion of the American public that's going, well, the government's, spying and on, but they're spying on all the right people in the country.
Right. Yeah. So there are actually, of course, long history of the U.S. government, the FBI, spying on citizens. It's on American citizens. But what changes, I suppose, in the mid 20th century is that this becomes much more obvious and much more publicized politicized in a sense, because it's not simply aliens and radicals as it was during World War One, but there's a kind of McCarthyist sweep a real debate that breaks out about the reach of the federal government and its kind of inquisitorial powers. At the same time as you have non-state actors that seem to have powers to intrude and invade into Americans' deeply intimate personal psychological lives through all kinds of new techniques. And some of those are adopted by the state and some aren't. But I'm thinking about things like, the psychological exams, personality testing at the workplace, various kinds of experiments to see how far you can get into people's consciousness and so forth. And so a whole new domain opens up around psychological invasions in the 1950s and 60s, again, only partly furthered by the state, but certainly, gets more attention probably because of the public knowledge about U.S. surveillance of its own citizens and, undemocratic kinds of trials, and people losing their jobs because of suspected communist or radical associations. So the 50s and 60s sees this really quite anxious and urgent debate about the shrinking space of privacy in American life and will, give rise to certain kinds of solutions or remedies. One of which, not directly, but is, I think, in response to all of this, is, finally a right to privacy as announced in the Supreme Court in 1965 in the case Griswold v. Connecticut, but also legislation, pretty far-reaching legislation like the Privacy Act of 1974. So there is a kind of response in terms of thinking about how to regulate and guard Americans' privacy, both their information privacy and their kind of privacy full stop. Those are not very effective remedies, and so the debate goes on.
Well, what's fascinating about that here is you have Griswold, which, of course, was about birth control, and mm-hmm. And ultimately became, in some respects, a foundation for Roe v. Wade. But simultaneously, yes. You also had people moving what was previously considered in the private realm to more to the public realm, right? Like, I mean, broadly speaking, their sexuality and their other things are now more transparent. So there's like a paradox there. It's being almost like legalized on some, you know, there's a legal structure that's being built, but society, the mores change.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, this is what makes this is what makes privacy such a fascinating, but also really challenging topic, I think, to get our heads around, because lots of things are moving at any given point. And what does happen, I think, the 70s are really critical for this. What's happening there is both more sensitivity to certain kinds of privacy invasions, one's data, identifying materials, anything that might be used in a kind of discriminatory fashion against them. At the same time that, yes, there's been a liberalization around certain kinds of personal material that would have been guarded very carefully in the 19th century and through the first half of the 20th century, but suddenly has been destigmatized. So sexuality, divorce, family dysfunction, alcoholism, and various kinds of medical conditions, right? So there were social movements that sort of were behind those and were the feminist movement, maybe first and foremost, but also gay liberation, also various kinds of other social movements that made those things as a political project less shameful, right? But at the same time, it's not as if there aren't other kinds of pieces of information that seem damaging in a different way. And this is where we start getting into worries that come along with a network society, with computer data banks, a computer that never forgets, as people would start to say. In the 1960s. So I think you see a kind of rise of information privacy concerns and calls to regulate corporate and government uses of identifying information at the same time that you see a kind of freeing of other kinds of personal and intimate details. And that's not even getting, you know, into the 80s and 90s and confessional memoirs and social media and blogs and so forth, right? It's already there, really, in the 1970s.
Right.
It's a psychological and a political movement, really.
So that dynamic carries through almost up until, you know, this sort of, we're in a new age now. And I would imagine, like, I mean, so the, you know, largely the story of your book is that privacy is a sort of, in a constant, it's never static. It's a constantly changing concept. And I imagine now the departure, particularly, I got to imagine, you know, I have a teenage daughter, that the concept of privacy for her is so radically different than it has been at any other stage, right? Because so much of what had been considered private even 20 years ago is now like, that's, we just throw that out the door now. Like, we like literally shove it out in the front yard.
Or the screen, or yeah, right. Whatever the equivalent is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there are continuities though, even in the differences. So I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, there is a kind of, freedom with which people share certain kinds of personal narratives and experiences that would have been, you know, utterly incomprehensible to someone like Louis Brandeis in 1890. On the other hand, to my mind, that some of the best studies of, say, teenage social media use, Dana Boyd's work, for example, suggests that teenagers are just as concerned about privacy as people have been
their parents are, but in a different way, and are figuring out different ways on a new platform to protect information that they only want to share with a few or want to share with no one versus the kind of information they're willing to broadcast more widely. So I think the tension remains. I don't think what we're seeing is a kind of abandonment of privacy. In fact, on the contrary, I would say, looking historically, you know, we're in a moment where people are thinking about and caring about privacy probably more than they have since at least the 1970s right now. So it's a little bit hard to decipher, but I think what we're seeing is a resetting of the terms, maybe, while also realizing how little control any of us has given what's already occurred, right? That so much of our information is already out there in the world, and we aren't going to be able to wrench it back in very easily. In fact, that's probably, you know, a game we can't even play. So when I think about our current moment, what strikes me is that what we're seeing is that collision or the crossing of two different trends. One is this one we were talking about earlier, which is the kind of letting go of and destigmatizing of certain kinds of personal information, which has led people to very freely talk about, write about, share information about themselves with an intensely profitable and sophisticated data mining, landscape that's come into place and was not related to that first trend, but is now, you know, able to use all that stuff that's out there in new ways and really threatening and unsettling ways. So I think that's generating, you know, our current debate and our current predicament, which is a pretty hard one for us to resolve, obviously.
How much of that paradox is a function of like a push for, it seems to me, in the late 21st century, the late 20th century and the early 21st century, sort of a bunch of private public type initiatives, right? Which was a big push, which essentially, you know, implies that the government trusts these private entities to do a lot of this stuff, right? Like, from prisons to farming out, immigration services, to farming out, to get data on behalf of the government, et cetera. And then there's sort of this whiplash with like, oh, wait a second. They have a different agenda, and we can't trust Facebook or whatnot.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think, my historian self would say, well, of course, there have always been these very blurry lines between corporate America and the government. I'm thinking back to the kind of use of the telegraph lines by the federal government, ability to sort of get into private communications and to subpoena corporate information, for example. So that goes way back, but I think nevertheless you're right that there has been a kind of tendency to both to privatize public goods or public functions, which is part of this. Even the Social Security number fits into this because a number that was meant to be only an identification of a federal account, essentially, retirement account, became a kind of number that was used by insurance agencies and credit bureaus and all kinds of other private corporations to do their work. So that, yes, that kind of pooling or sharing of information, whether intentional or not, you know, whether the U.S. government is cooperating with Google or Google is cooperating with U.S. government, the fact that this information is seems to be porous and accessible has certainly contributed to our current problems because it becomes very unclear who is responsible ultimately for what information is being collected, how it's being used, how it's moving around, whether it can be stopped, whether it can ever be erased. You know, those are, I think, some of our most important debates right now, and they're very hard to figure out because it's pretty unclear either technologically or politically what the limits to information sharing may be.
Indeed. It's fascinating, a book, The Known Citizen, A History of Privacy in Modern America, Professor Sarah Igo, thanks so much for your time today. I also have to just add, it just occurs to me too, like that Social Security number, huge financial gift to the private industry,
yes.
Right? I mean,
right.
What would
right.
they do? What would they yeah. do if they didn't have that number? Across platforms to from everything to do with credit and identification. It's fascinating. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
They're totally unintended.
We will put a link to the Known Citizen at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate
it. Wonderful. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Bye-bye.